Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dr. Jeff Halper, coordinating director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, who discusses his group's efforts to stop the Israeli military's systematic destruction of Palestinian homes and ways to strengthen the prospects for lasting peace. Derek Yak, one of the principal drafters of the International Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, who explains the importance of the treaty and the reasons why President Bush may oppose ratification. And Anne Stanbeck, president of the group Love Makes a Family, who assesses pending legislation in Connecticut that can make the state the second in the nation to adopt civil unions for same-sex couples. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
6 years ago, Seattle labor activist Mark Waghorn was in the streets protesting the World Trade Organization, which galvanized media focus on the emerging global movement against large financial institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. Now, Waghorn, an officer in the group Public Services International, got some inside access when he sat on a panel of civil society activists who questioned the new candidates for WTO Director General. The panel, part of the hiring process, was a first for the WTO. Major international non-governmental organizations like Oxfam and Amnesty International are now dealing with top corporate leaders on issues like fair trade and human rights. In addition, the World Bank has opened up its meetings, published documents on its website, and responds to social and environmental critics. Groups like Greenpeace have convinced Whirlpool to use eco-friendly insulation. Under pressure from the Rainforest Action Network, Home Depot and Lowe's have agreed to sell green-certified lumber. Even De Beers Group, the diamond mining giant and longtime foe of human rights groups, has been pressured to make deals with its critics like London-based Global Witness over the issue of conflict diamonds. But despite gains for civil society in their fight to have a say in international economic policies, fundamental decisions remain in the hands of a small group of rich and powerful men. Foreshadowing the struggles ahead was an indication from the White House that U.S. Deputy Secretary of Defense and prominent neoconservative Paul Wolfowitz is a leading candidate to head the World Bank. The proposed Bush federal budget is tough on domestic programs outside of the Department of Homeland Security. It calls for a 16% cut in funding for education, health, the environment, and research and development. Many of these budget cuts were rejected by Congress before, but this year may be different, observes the American Prospect magazine. The record budget deficit, created in part by tax cuts for the wealthy, is soaring, and pressure to cut red ink is mounting and coming from many quarters, including Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan. Progressive groups such as the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities foresee the most intense budget fight since 1995, when the Newt Gingrich-run House of Representatives shut down the federal government. The growing deficit could also lead to major cuts in the Medicaid health care program that assists poor women and children, and the growing numbers of elderly in nursing homes. Already, the Bush White House is calling for a 2% cut in overall Medicaid spending and wants to give governors more power to reduce health benefits. Advocates also worry what New Hampshire Republican Senator Judd Gregg will do as chairman of the Senate Budget Committee. Gregg is a self-proclaimed deficit hawk and eager to reduce the cost of entitlements like Medicaid and Medicare. Gregg voted against the Bush-led Medicare drug benefit bill in 2003, showing little sympathy for expanding health care access to excluded groups like senior citizens and the poor. Facing a March 15th court deadline, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is set to release new mercury emission regulations that are expected to allow polluters to trade rights to release the toxic agent. According to Public Citizen, the Bush administration is pushing the emissions trading scheme, instead of forcing utilities and other power producers to install new technology that would cut mercury emissions 90% by 2008. At the moment, Texas is the biggest polluter of mercury emissions due to weaker power plant regulations. As Tom Smitty Smith, head of Public Citizen's Texas office, stated, trading rights of a toxin has never been allowed before due to health risks, which include the creation of toxic hotspots. Exposure to mercury, a neurotoxin, can cause retardation, seizures, and lead to disabilities in children. 44 states have issued health warnings limiting ingestion of freshwater fish because of high mercury levels. A recent study by the EPA also found that 17% of women of childbearing age have dangerous levels of mercury in their blood. Meanwhile, states like Wisconsin, New Jersey, and Connecticut have moved to clamp down on mercury emissions from power plants. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Since the election of Mahmoud Abbas as president of the Palestinian Authority, there's been renewed hope that progress could be made in restarting negotiations leading to a viable peace between Israelis and Palestinians. But a Palestinian suicide bombing on February 25th in Tel Aviv that killed five Israelis shattered a fragile ceasefire and caused the government of Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon to delay the promised release of Palestinian prisoners and a pullback from West Bank cities. Abbas, reacting angrily to the delay in implementation, accused Sharon of undermining peace efforts and threatening what had been achieved thus far in restarting the peace process. He went on to say that Palestinians would not accept an expansion of Jewish settlements in the West Bank as a trade-off for Sharon's planned withdrawal of Israeli settlers from Gaza. Sharon maintains that Abbas must take firm action to dismantle militant groups before fundamental issues can be addressed. Although the U.S. press rarely focuses on Israel's peace movement, many Israelis support the withdrawal of all settlements from Palestinian territory in exchange for security. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dr. Jeff Halper, coordinating director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions and a professor of anthropology, who talks about his group's efforts to stop the Israeli military's systematic destruction of Palestinian homes. Dr. Halper, an American Jew who emigrated to Israel in 1973, also discusses policy changes that he believes could increase the prospects for lasting peace.
The Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions is a coalition of a number of Israeli peace and human rights groups. We've been working since 1997 in general to resist the occupation, but in particular we focus on the issue of house demolitions because it seems to us almost the essence of the conflict. Since 1967, Israel's demolished about 12,000 Palestinian homes. And in 95% of the cases, they have nothing to do with security, with terrorism, with violence. Simply demolishing homes either through collective punishment or through administrative court orders in order to take the land of the Palestinians. So overall, if you combine that with the demolition of more than 400 Palestinian villages after 1948, we're looking at a whole process of displacement. So in our committee, we resist the demolition of homes. We get in front of the bulldozers, or we chain ourselves in the homes in order to resist the demolition. But when houses are demolished, we rebuild homes. Israeli volunteers, together with Palestinians, in order to affirm that we refuse to be enemies, that we as Israelis recognize that the Palestinians are in the country, they have a right to be there, and in the end that we have to find a way to live together.
It's been several years since Rachel Corrie, a young American who was part of the International Solidarity Movement, stood in front of a Palestinian home and was killed by an Israeli military bulldozer. People who were with her claimed that it was a deliberate act on the part of the Israeli military. What's the significance of Rachel Corrie's death in your work?
Well, I mean, Rachel Corrie really represented what we call the international civil society. I was certainly involved in trying to end apartheid in South Africa. Rachel Corrie was a very concerned American who was involved in trying to end the occupation, you know, in Israel and in Palestine. And from that point of view, she really represented, I think, the conscience of people all over who sit at home and say, what can I do to make the world a better place? So she really represents for us the ideal of what we would like everyone to be, especially young people today, and that are the people that get out of their homes and that put themselves in harm's way, in a sense, in order to protect oppressed people everywhere.
Dr. Helper, what's your reaction to Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's unilateral plan to withdraw settlers from the Gaza Strip? And what do you think the effects will be on the overall peace process?
Well, I mean, Sharon himself has said, and this has been published in all the Israeli papers and many papers abroad, that the withdrawal from Gaza, the disengagement, is intended to actually freeze the peace process. The word that the head of his office used was to put the peace process in formaldehyde. The idea is that Gaza is the only real flashpoint between Israel and the Palestinians. The West Bank has been pacified. It's very hard to pacify Gaza because you've got about 1.5 million Palestinians jammed into a little tiny area, impoverished, with really nothing to lose. So that by getting the army out and by getting the 7,000 settlers out, Israel still controls Gaza. It has a fence around it. People can't get out. There's a barricade of the sea. There's a barricade of the airspace. So the Palestinians are still living in a cage. But Israel's able to eliminate that kind of a flashpoint. And then the idea of the formaldehyde is that then when there's a quiet, when the Palestinian resistance is not in the news anymore, and the whole issue begins to disappear from the front pages, that then there'll be no more pressures on Israel. Israel can quietly go ahead strengthening its settlements in the West Bank. And in the end, Israel can prevail over the Palestinians. The occupation will win in the West Bank at the price of having given up Gaza, which really Israel has no interest in retaining anyway. All the polls show that 70% of the Israeli public have absolutely no interest in pursuing the occupation. They want separation. They want the wall, actually. They simply want to disconnect from the Palestinians. You know, Barak, in 1999, was elected prime minister on the slogan, "Us here, them there." That's what the Israeli public wants. It's also not a great position. I mean, I would rather have an Israeli public that's looking for peace and reconciliation and good neighborly relations and integration. They're not. They don't want anything to do with Palestinians. But they certainly, 70% of the public is certainly not interested in perpetuating the occupation. You know, people don't know this, but in the Bush-Sharon agreement of last April, the United States government agreed that Israel can annex 30% of the West Bank in terms of its settlement blocks. So on the one hand, the American government is sponsoring an initiative, the roadmap, that talks about achieving two states, ending the occupation. It talks about a viable Palestinian state, which is great. Whereas on the other hand, that same administration says to Israel, yes, you can annex 30% of the West Bank, which absolutely destroys any possibility of a viable Palestinian state emerging. So I think the Bush administration is trying to play a double game here. You know, with the help of the Bush administration, not only isn't Israel more secure, but there's a good chance this conflict could last for another 50 years, which would be a disaster for everyone.
That was Dr. Jeff Halper, coordinating director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. Learn more about the group by visiting their website at www.icahd.org. An international anti-tobacco treaty went into effect on February 27th that aims to reduce smoking-related disease and death around the world. The Framework Convention on Tobacco Control was signed by 168 countries, but so far ratified by only 57, including some of the largest nations, such as India, Japan, and Germany. Two major countries that have not yet ratified the treaty are China, which is expected to, and the United States, where Senate ratification is uncertain. Ratifying nations must set targets for imposing price and tax increases on cigarettes, enact laws to protect the public from secondhand smoke, and enforce restrictions on the sale of tobacco products to minors, among other things. The World Health Organization estimates that tobacco-related illness kills one smoker every 6.5 seconds around the globe. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Derek Yak, the official from the World Health Organization in charge of drafting the treaty, which was completed in 2003. He now heads the Division of Global Health at Yale University's School of Public Health. He says in order to be effective, the treaty needs protocols that set up specific reduction targets. And he explains that while the U.S. Justice Department has taken a strong stand against abuses by tobacco companies, the Bush administration may still oppose ratification of this treaty.
The U.S. has virtually no federal legislation on the books on tobacco control. All of it is either through agreement with the tobacco industries, which could later be overturned by disagreement, or it's activities that happen at the local and state level. Even your warnings are very puny by world standards, and that is one federal activity. I think that the main block doesn't actually lie in the influence of tobacco companies or the concern of the tobacco industry by the administration. I think it's a deeper concern which relates to multilateralism itself. So it's less the content of tobacco than the fact that joining a treaty strengthens the whole role of the United Nations system. And I think that is a substantive debate at the moment going on in this administration.
What are the teeth in the treaty as it stands now, if there are teeth?
I think the most powerful teeth starting to come out are the convening of the countries itself. The actual process has already raised up the stakes for tobacco control as being critical in the public health arena generally. And it's meant that already, before they actually convene, many countries have taken the measures already in the treaty. So it's having a powerful advocacy role. It's getting mobilization of NGOs. But what we will require to actually address the transnational aspects, cross-border advertising, internet advertising, satellite television, illicit trade, better product regulation across the world, will be protocols. The protocols should have the specificity and the detail to address the transnational aspect. That's really why one has a framework convention.
Do you see any blocks to that process happening?
I think there are potentially many blocks. The first is finance. The financing of the next steps will be as much as it took to get us here. And it was tough in an environment where funding for health generally is only going up in the area of HIV/AIDS. No country has put a new amount of money on the table to accelerate the process. Many foundations that were previously in tobacco control have stepped back from it, like the Rockefeller Foundation. So funding is a big constraint. The second is the political will and advocacy to move with a greater sense of urgency by the World Health Organization itself. Since Gro Harlem Brundtland, who was the Prime Minister of Norway for 10 years and the head of the World Health Organization for the 5 years that the convention was being developed, since she's left, you've lacked a very high-level, very visible leader who in every interaction, not with a health minister, but with a head of state, would stress the importance of tobacco control. And there was something very daunting when you would be a prime minister of Japan or you were the chancellor of Germany and you would face Brundtland telling you that you need to get your tobacco act in order for the sake of your population and for the sake of the rest of the world. Many heads of state tended to act when they actually had that kind of strong advocacy. That's virtually gone now.
Do you have any numbers on the number of people who die every year from tobacco-related diseases?
The figures are that about 5 million people die every year from tobacco, and we expect the figures to rise to 10 million a year by the 2020s, with already 1 million deaths from tobacco a year in China and 700,000 a year in India. The U.S., it's about 440,000 a year. When it comes to AIDS, the figure is probably in the range 3 to 4 million a year, but that figure is also rising. We need to improve the amount of finance generally for all public health issues because it has an impact not just on health but on economies. When it comes to tobacco control, the good news is that one doesn't need the billions of dollars which are having to go into AIDS treatment. One really needs strategically placed money, maybe in the tens, maybe up to 100 million, which would allow governments to put in place the tax system to increase taxes on tobacco and create a self-generating mechanism for tobacco control. So in fact, good tobacco control more than pays its way. And in those countries like Thailand, who have taken a tiny fraction of the tobacco tax and used it for health promotion and tobacco control, they found that everybody wins. Finance wins, the government wins, public health wins, and the population support tobacco taxes more than any other forms of taxes, particularly if they know it's going to go to a good cause.
The numbers are dropping in some countries. Are they dropping in the U.S.?
Yes, the smoking rates have been going down slowly and steadily in the U.S. They've been going down very fast in my own country, South Africa, as they've stepped up taxes and banned advertising. They're even going down in some of the developing countries like Thailand. They're going down in Poland. And throughout most of Western Europe, they're going down. The concern is that they remain high in Asia and Africa, and that the rates among young girls and young women are starting to rise off a very low base in those countries, meaning that we are likely to see an epidemic unfold among women over the next 20 to 30 years.
That was Derek Yak, formerly of the World Health Organization, who spearheaded the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. For more information, visit the organization's website at www.who.int. Connecticut state legislature is now considering a bill that could make the state the second in the nation, following Vermont, to adopt civil union protections for same-sex couples. Backers of the legislation predicted final passage after the powerful Judiciary Committee endorsed the measure in a 25-13 vote, and Connecticut's Republican Governor Jody Rell openly gave her support. Civil unions provide same-sex couples with many of the same rights and responsibilities as traditional marriage, including a voice in medical care issues and legal standing to inherit money and property. But civil unions are not recognized across state borders or by the federal government. Whatever the final outcome of the legislation, Connecticut's courts will also be weighing in on the issue after deciding a lawsuit filed by 7 gay and lesbian couples after they were denied a Connecticut marriage license in August. A coalition backing gay marriage in the state originally opposed the civil union bill, but changed course when supportive legislators promised that they would not abandon the fight for full marriage rights for gay couples. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ann Stanbeck, president of the group Love Makes a Family, Connecticut's main coalition working for same-sex marriage equality. Stanbeck explains the shifting debate on the legislation and why she views gay marriage as a civil rights issue.
The original bill that was raised in the Judiciary Committee and had a public hearing back on February the 7th, I believe, was a bill entitled Marriage Equality. And it was, you know, just a pretty straightforward marriage bill that would allow same-sex couples to have access to all the rights and protections of civil marriage in the state. We had a wonderful public hearing. There actually wasn't a single person on either side, I don't think, said that they would supported civil union, because all the people who were there to speak in favor of the bill supported marriage, and the supporters didn't support civil union because didn't think it was the same as marriage. The opponents said very clearly that they oppose civil union because they do view it as the same as marriage. So it was sort of an ironic situation. The vote that happened in the Judiciary Committee was on an amendment to strip out the marriage language and turn that marriage bill into a bill that allowed for civil unions, very similar to what passed in Vermont 5 years ago. And it did pass overwhelmingly, and I certainly recognize that that is a huge step forward in terms of the support that we have in the Judiciary Committee. But probably from our perspective, what was most heartening about that debate and that vote was, first of all, the very sound defeat of two DOMA amendments, these so-called Defense of Marriage Acts that defines marriages between a man and a woman. By a over 2-to-1 margin, both a what they call a statutory DOMA and a constitutional amendment were defeated. And that was great news, and I think shows that Connecticut is really very different from much of the rest of the country, based on what we saw in the last election cycle. But as optimistic as anything we heard that day were the strong statements of support by many of the legislators, many who voted for the civil union bill and one who voted against it, all saying that this is not equal, this is not enough, and that they pledge to stand with us to continue the fight for full equality and for full civil marriage. So after that vote, Love Makes a Family's board met again. We had opposed the civil union legislation, but we decided that we would not stand in the way of this legislation and withdrew our active opposition.
Anne Stanback, what are the essential features in this civil union bill approved by the Judiciary Committee in terms of a partner's ability to make decisions in medical issues or inheritance or other issues that are primarily addressed in marriage?
There are a whole range of things that the civil union bill would cover, things like the automatic right to make medical decisions for your partner or your spouse if they are incapacitated, or to have hospital visitation, the right to a whole range of employment benefits, everything from employee health insurance on one's partner's or spouse's health care plan, to the ability to use family and medical leave to take care of your partner or a family member. There's significant tax benefits, particularly tax benefits that deal with home ownership, inheritance rights, pension rights. Much of this can be covered under federal law, which civil unions don't cover, but there are definitely significant advantages that civil unions will offer.
Anne Stanback, what's the significance nationally of what it looks like the Connecticut State Legislature is about to do in voting in a civil union bill? Might it mean that Connecticut joins California as the only state where the legislature voted in a civil union bill?
I think it does, and I think that we know that both the legislature and the judicial branch have their roles to play in civil rights movements. And many of the marriage fights that are going forward around the country with the most prospects of success are doing so through the courts. It's very important that we have some wins in the legislature, and I do know that California is moving forward with marriage legislation. I think the fact that Connecticut is doing this, while it's not everything we want and it's not the full equality and protections of marriage, it is an important message, and I think that it is going to be a stepping stone to marriage. As Evan Wolfson, who's one of the leaders of this movement, often says, wins Trump losses. And yeah, there were losses in the election of 2004, but there are going to be some significant wins in this next year. And I think that they are going to actually carry much more power than some of these constitutional amendments that were simply reiterating laws that had been passed in state legislatures. I think the future looks optimistic. We can't let down our guard, but we have more and more fair-minded Americans who understand that this is simply a matter of fairness and of civil rights.
That was Anne Stanback, president of Love Makes a Family. Contact the group by calling area code 860-525-7777 or visit their website at www.lmfct.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer-Cousineau.